friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. It's the best time of the year.
I don't like this Christmas song. Just for the record, I don't even know why I'm playing it. But I grew up with it, right? Burl Ives was the voice of Santa Claus on some, like, Norelco Santa Claus thing. Anyway, there you have it. And joining me now is a Marine turned writer. A friend of the Gunners gave her name to Mike. Mike said, "Hey, man, you need to interview her. I just got off the phone with her after 2 hours, and wow." So joining me is the author of a new book entitled Thank You for Raping Me, and her name is Athena Ives. So, Athena, first of all, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. I must say it's a little bit of cruel and unusual punishment to play Christmas music before I've had my coffee, but I'm kidding.
Well, that means you should get up earlier. What the hell, man?
Well, similar to what a lot of other veterans are facing is dreams, bad dreams, you know, just those hard-to-sleep nights where a little more difficult to get up in the morning, but I am awake now.
All right. Well, you're going to get no sympathy here. So just for the rest of us, like, deal with it. So you're on the West Coast with me, yes, in the San Diego area.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So before we can know if we should believe you, we have to go there. We have to find out about you. So born and raised where?
I was born in California, and then my family moved around a lot, Washington, different places, and then they relocated us to Michigan when I was 11 years old.
All right, so
Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Mm-hmm. So you're in Michigan, and is that, if I said what's home for you, that's where you would point on a map?
Oh, God, no. I don't even like to say that's where I live.
Okay.
No, I was not a fan of that state. No, I moved back to California when I was 20.
Ah, so where did you go to high school?
In California, in Grand Rapids. It's a little town outside of Grand Rapids. But anyways, yeah. So I went to high school in Grand Rapids, and yeah.
All right. So you grew up in outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and family moved around a lot. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
The only military background in my family was my older brother joined the Army, but that was already after, it was his way of escaping, and it was, so basically his, Army to influence him.
Hold on, yeah. Escaping what?
A really messed up family,
okay.
Childhood.
Right.
My parents were nightmares, so.
Okay, so you grow up in a nightmare family, which
mm-hmm.
is not atypical in the Marine Corps to find people that use the military to get out of a situation like that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the Marine Corps gets on your radar. Well, the Army certainly does. At what point do you seriously start looking at the military, and how do you get pointed towards the Marine Corps, which we all know is door number four, right?
Yeah. In my situation, it was more like, door, don't go down.
Exactly.
I joined very late. I was 24 when I joined. So I had already had a job. I was a preschool teacher at the time. And my roommates were, one was a female Marine and the other one was a Navy Marine. I got along with the Marines that I hung out with my friend, and I'm always the kind of person that, you know, I don't bash the other branches, but facts are, it's a more difficult branch to get into. The training is more difficult. It's longer, you know, all that.
So you say that as a statement of fact and not really as bashing?
It is fact, because I actually, for my master's thesis, I compared branches and their physical requirements to get in, and Marine Corps is up, you know, above the others.
So now that you're a more educated person, you've proven it empirically, and now we can use that to shit talk them.
I like empirical evidence. You can't argue with that.
There you go. Well, not to say that they won't, but it's nice to know that it's now empirically based. It's just not us lifting off. That's
exactly.
So, but 24 years old to go become a private in the Marine Corps. So were you not happy teaching school? What was going on?
I loved teaching, but you don't make enough. I was barely able to afford paying rent, and, you know, that was sharing a room. So I wanted to travel as well. I didn't join the Marine Corps to travel. I wasn't that idiot that walked in and believed the recruiters.
Whoa, let's not go there. All right?
Why? It's the truth, right? Empirical evidence. How many people were told by their recruiter that they could travel?
I wanted to travel a little bit. It got me around the planet a few times. So, come on. Be careful with the rock sling so early in the interview.
No, I just knew going in that I wasn't expecting to travel, but the opportunity and the money and the leave would give you that opportunity.
All right. So but still, 24 years old, that's pretty old. And you decide to make this. What drives you to the Marine Corps?
The people I met, and then it being the most difficult branch. I was like, why join the military if you aren't going to go all the way? And to me, going all the way was being a Marine.
What'd your brother say?
I didn't tell anybody until I was in boot camp.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so, yeah, they got a lovely, oh, hi, I sold my soul to the devil.
Nice. Well, that's good. That's interesting. I you're the first person I've had ever say that on this show, that I told my family once I was there. What about, so you go through recruit training, and what did you think of that?
The physical side, I was well prepared for because I was a soccer athlete going in. That was pretty much a big reason why I didn't join sooner, was because I had a full ride to play soccer in college. So I couldn't pass that up, and that was my passion. I just wanted to play the rest of my life. But
where did you go do that? Where'd you go? You obviously go through your teaching. You graduated from college. We skipped over that. So you went to college on a full soccer ride. Where?
Yes. So it was a small private Catholic school in Michigan, and I tore every ligament in my knee the third game into the season.
Nice.
So the next 2 years were trying to come back after that, but my knee was just too badly damaged to play at that professional of a level. So I had to, but they took away my scholarship and I couldn't afford it anymore. So I ended up moving to California, didn't finish my degree. And yeah, so that brought me to California, and then I was teaching, and then from there I joined the Marine Corps.
Okay, explain something to me. I thought you had to have a degree to be a teacher.
Not for preschool. I don't know if it's changed by now, but I was teaching, the class I was teaching was the 4 and 5 year olds, which is pre-K, so this is before they get to kindergarten.
Okay.
But I had to go back to school to get more units for child education development. So I had all those units along with others, but I didn't have that degree yet.
Okay. All right. So you're in boot camp. The physical thing's good. What part is at any point is boot camp challenging?
Oh yeah, they like starve us. It's horrible, and I think they kind of. I had written a letter home, and just saying, was talking shit about our guide, because it was, she couldn't run, she couldn't do anything, and. I say young, but compared to the other kids, I wasn't young. You know, there's like 18, 17, 18-year-olds in there. But for me, I still had that, you know, looking back like 10, 11 years ago, you look back at yourself and you're like, oh my gosh, why did I do that? What was I thinking? And that's kind of what, you know, what was I thinking writing home and talking shit about instructors.
Those are always interesting letters if people keep them. You open them and read them. I kept a diary for the first day in OCS for the first like 2 or 3 days, and then I stopped. But I still have that, and I read it and I laugh. Like, yeah, your world turns upside down, and you're in a bit of kind of like Disneyland, an artificial environment, and it's where crazy things are happening. So if you do record those events in letters and things like that, and people do hold on to them, it is pretty interesting stuff. But again,
they found the letter and they read it in front of the whole platoon.
Oh, no.
And they're all like, so, you know, recruit Ives, did you really think you could be a better guy? I stand up. Yes, senior drill instructor, blah, 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 I do. And so they gave me the position of guide, and my ass paid for it. Like, I got in such great shape. Oh, yeah.
All right, explain to everybody what a guide is. Just not everybody knows.
It's, if you guys ever watch ceremonies or anything, it's the person holding the guide on with, you know, the flag or unit's flag. Any ceremonial, you know, marches or whatever you guys want to say. And it's also, you're almost like the leader of that entire group. So it's your Everyone in your under you is it's your responsibility. So it's like you become the parent of that entire group.
Did you retain that position till the end of boot camp? Or
I sure did. No. I wasn't going to let it go. I even had a stress fracture right before the crucible, and they're like, well, we're going to have to drop you. And I was like, hell no. I didn't come this far to only come this far. I'm taking this title home with me. So.
Well done. So you graduated. Are you the honor graduate at boot camp?
I was. I've missed Iron Woman by like 3 seconds, too. So pissed.
You know, the Marine Corps is recruiting women like you know. No, honestly, I mean, all the efforts are through USA Soccer, through wrestling, USA Wrestling. They're all rugby. I mean, you know, the Marine Corps, in their studies and in their recruiting, we need more physical women and that have played some kind of combative, hopefully physical sport. Water polo comes to mind as well, that, you know, because so they'll be used to competitive and they'll be used to pushing themselves physically. So, so interesting, and probably no surprise given your age and your physical abilities that you were able to do that. All right. So where does the Marine Corps take you after boot camp?
I signed up. There were some underlying circumstances that made me join a lot faster than I had chosen to. I had a breakup and I just needed to get out of there. So I joined and signed under the, what is it, ground combat option. And they, because I was going for intel or MP, the intel slots were all filled up. So I was thinking of going MP because I ultimately wanted to do like NCIS or something like that, criminal investigations for the military. So I signed up underground combat, being told, this is where I fell for it, that I would be able to more than likely be MP. So after MCT, Marine Combat Training, I was sitting there waiting to hear where we were going to the schools, and they call my name, and they're like, oh, you're 1371, a combat engineer. I was like, what the hell is that? My instructor is like, oh, that's the baddest job in the world. You get to blow things up and find mines and build, you know, build things. I was like, oh, no, I don't like bombs. I don't like anything I don't like anything you just said right now. But it turned out to be pretty awesome, you know, being able to blow things up, work with TNT and C4, and that was pretty cool.
So, what year is this?
This was back in 2006.
I didn't think they opened up those MOSs till the last, right, like, 3 years or so?
Women?
Yeah, so you could have been a combat engineer in 2006? That was not...
There was a number of us, but we weren't allowed in division yet. So you could go to
that's interesting. You learn something new every day here. What about, where does that, 2006, the Marine Corps is at war in Iraq and Afghanistan with the rest of the country, with the rest of the military. So where does that take you?
I graduated from school and went to Pendleton and did Bridgeport cold weather training. That was, oh my God, I wouldn't wish that on anyone.
And so you're with what unit now?
I was over with 7th ESB.
So you're at
7th. Support battalion.
7th ESB, and that's part of what? The MLG as part of OneMAF, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, and then, your career continues to progress. What happens next?
Then we were doing on the pre-deployment checklist, like health stuff, and I was getting my knee evaluated, and they sent me for an MRI, and it came back, and I had just ran a 300 PFT.
Right.
And it came back, and they're like, you know, we're med-sepping you right now. You have the knee of, like, a 90-year-old woman, and you're going to need a knee replacement in 2 years unless you stop all physical activity. And I was like, no, I want a second, third, fourth opinion. So I ended up fighting that, but they dropped me from the roster, so I didn't deploy with that unit, and finally got back to full duty. I refused to. They gave me a light duty chit, and I refused to use it. I was like, no, I can PT with just as good as they can. So And then we got orders to deploy for Fallujah in, we left the, like, Christmas.
Of what year?
It was Christmas of 2008.
Of 2008. And so.
Actually, it was after Christmas.
After Christmas 2008. So you get med boarded and you win the med board. They don't separate you.
Yeah, I didn't even have to go on a board.
Really?
I got enough doctors to sign off on it, so no board. And then they gave us orders. I went home. I went home the Christmas of 2007, knowing that I was deploying. That it was February, yeah. Because it was like Valentine's Day. We were at March Air Force Base, and I remember seeing all the cheesy hearts up everywhere.
Nice. Yeah, we love March Air Force Base. They have great peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Oh yeah.
The So this is February, March of 2008.
Yes.
And you're still with 7th ESB?
No, we got attached to a different unit, CLB-1. Combat Logistics Battalion 1.
CLB-1. All right. Mm-hmm. And so you go to, you're headed for Fallujah. You get to Fallujah, and what's your job specifically? What do you do?
Well, I was a combat engineer, so we did a lot of prefabbing and different things like that. But before I went, I volunteered to be part of the Lioness Group, which is very similar to the FET team, which is female engagement teams. And they were put, I think it started back in 2006, 2005, 2006, when women weren't allowed in combat, but what they found was that the insurgents were smuggling in weapons and contraband with the women, or hiding it with the women on patrols. And a lot of weapons were getting into the city, so they needed women to serve with the infantry units in order to be able to search the women, which the men weren't able to.
I saw it as early as 2004 in Ramadi with the 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines. They had... I want to say one of the first efforts of quote unquote lioness units, and and during raids, the women would be segregated, and these female Marines would deal with the women through male interpreters, but they would be the female Marines doing it, and but it was all very embryonic at the time, trying to find a way not to violate people culturally, which I think we do we try hard not to do anyway, and so you get assigned to be part of that effort.
Yes. It was volunteer basis. They can't make you do it. And that's why I joined the military. Like, I can't be a grunt. I can't, you know, do what I want to do. So this is the closest I will ever come to it. And I volunteered for that. And the training we were given back then was, I mean, this is what happened. I went to 29 Palms for pre-deployment, all the training, and they're like, oh, hey, eyes are over with this group. It sent over there. There's like 300 guys and me. And I was like, oh, hi. And then they're like, oh, we're going to do the special effects, 48-hour effects. And we had to be in full combat, everything, for 48 hours. Couldn't take it off. It was like learning how to pee with a... That was a bitch, man. That was not fun. But, hey, he had apt and overcome, and no one ever knew I was having any issues with those kind of things. It's just, you just deal with it. Whatever. It's a fact of life. Get over it and move on.
You wanted to be treated special or something?
No, absolutely not.
Right.
That's what was nice.
Welcome to the world of the unspecial. So so you go do that, and that was what we used to call that Enhanced Mojave Viper with the role players and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, that was so much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
No, I'll tell you what, it's great training, too. I mean, Marine Corps and the DOD spent a lot of money on that kind of stuff. I was blown away when I saw it the first time, like, whoa.
It was the best training I had since I joined the military.
Really?
It was amazing. And I loved being with the infantry group. The grunts were incredible. I felt at home with them. They treated me better than anyone in my unit did.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not really their legacy. But they're wonderful people. It's my tribe, so I don't want to get over my skis. But that's not treating people well is not normally. Well, there's kind of a meritocracy though. If you show that you can hack it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're a non-hacker, you would not have been. you would have been treated like the rest of the non-hackers, and that is not very good. So obviously you performed your way into being treated well. So congratulations to you. So you go through that, right? That's pre-deployment training, and then you get to Iraq, and you're a combat engineer and with CLB-1. And where are you, and what are you doing when you get there?
I was in Zebra in the main base in Fallujah, but when I would volunteer to go out, I would, you know, be like, oh, hey, be over here at, you know, 05, and they're going to come pick you up. We didn't really always know where we were going, but usually we did, so we could pack accordingly, because different missions, you were there for a certain period of time. So it was one, you'd be out there for 5 days,
right.
Another one, only one, so I'd always volunteer for the longest mission.
So explain to me how it worked. You would be doing your day job on a regular basis as a combat engineer, and then you would get an email, or how would you be notified that, hey, we're going to do Lioness stuff, so how did that work?
I was one of the only females in the battalion that wanted to do it, especially after the first few times out, the women realized how dangerous and how much work it was, so they didn't volunteer.
Okay.
So I was like, all the slots were open. I was like, here, me. So they would just, it's almost like training where they have to fill in slots, like, oh, well, we need two more, hey, over here, you're over here. And, you know, how the whole voluntold thing goes, but
you got to pick which missions you went on. That's all. What a good deal.
Yeah, it was awesome. They gave, like, they had the checkpoints. So 5, 2, 3, 1 hit, which puts and then the training officer would fill that in, and then they would let us know where to be. Like, our platoon sergeant would be like, hey, you need to be over here at 05 tomorrow. Okay, cool.
Let me interject. And what happens is, you know, for instance, say we're going to do snap these vehicle checkpoints, which were incredibly effective around Fallujah. And I was there in 2006. And so if you were fortunate to have a lioness there, you could search grandma. Okay? And all of a sudden, you find out that grandma has blasting caps taped to her thighs, her gut, right, her shoulders, her arms, everywhere. And you couldn't do that, you know, before. But the Iraqis are smart. They know where we wouldn't go, and they exploited that. Talk about some of the things that you found.
Well, we were always, especially with the increase in temperature, we were briefed that due to the increase in temperature with, you know, heat coming up, there's going to be a lot more activity. And so we would get briefed every time, like before we would go out for a mission, they would bring me in and brief me on all the things that we needed to look out for. So, there's been an increase in female suicide bombers. So look for this, and this. There's been an increase in this. Make sure you guys keep your eyes out for this. And we would get briefed as well at the checkpoints. A lot of times they would be looking for intel, so they would come and let us know what to look for and who to look for and different things like that. So how it worked at the entry checkpoints, ECPs, is there would be, you know, I don't know how far, a rock's throw far in front would be where they would stop the vehicle and the bomb dogs would be out there. And then the women and children and whoever wasn't driving the car had to get out and walk down this long path to be searched. The men searched the men, and I searched all the women and the children. So there would just be, I called it the Sea of Black, because it was just like all these women just covered in their burkas, like with their little eye holes showing. And we would have to have them come into this hut and have them lift it up, and then we would have to pat them down and search whatever they brought in with them. And that, a lot of people don't understand that they knew where we were, so if they wanted to blow us all up, that's exactly where they should go, because it was, you know, they knew where to go. And it was one of the most dangerous parts of the, you know, the city, because not only did they hate Marines and us being there, but they hated the women even more. They despised the women, and we had death threats all the time. We got shot at all the time. We had I think the craziest, it's kind of a really fucked up situation. The worst thing I did find was before I went on this mission, we were briefed that they were smuggling contraband in, hidden in dead babies. And what they were doing was, because in order to come through the city to get to the hospital, you had to go through this checkpoint. So we saw, all the kids coming in with the arms blown off, women with their breasts melted off from acid. It was gnarly. It's something you have nightmares from. And one woman brought, walked in and had a baby. Baby wasn't moving, so I went to feel it, and it was dead. And I was like, God damn it. So I had to have everyone leave. The woman was outside hysterically screaming, but I had to open it up and found a plastic bag inside. So I didn't mess with it. I just covered it up and called it in, and they dealt with it. So, yeah.
People poo-pooed that when it was going on. Oh, you guys are overreacting. You can't search our women, you know. And the Iraqis were like, "Oh, this is against our culture." But it had been used against us so many times.
Yes.
Whether it be Red Crescent ambulances, or we were trying to, in 2006, we were trying to kill a guy named Zarqawi, who supposedly used female garb to move around Al Anbar. So they knew the places we went going, and they freely exploited it. Let me pause your time in Fallujah there and go back now. You were raped when you were 13.
I was.
And it's not an insignificant part of the story. Talk to us about that incident.
I was 13, and my brother. Not my stepbrother, he was my biological brother. He started raping me. And he was, before that, he was a very violent person. He was 2 years older than me. Everything from almost drowning me to he would stick me in head first in a sleeping bag and sit on it on top of me until I would cry and piss myself. And they would lock me in places. He was just a really horrible, horrible person. And I didn't tell anyone. And then it was too traumatic to deal with as a child.
Hold on, let me ask you. So what, did you not feel that you could tell your mother and father? Did you not have that kind of relationship with them?
No, we weren't close at all. Not at all. They're very cold, extremely religious, Reformed Baptist. You don't talk about feelings.
So
it's
you,
just something you don't talk to your parents about, or at least
They're Baptists are a fairly uptight part of the segment. Yeah. Southern Baptists, right? Black Baptists look like the most fun people. White Baptists, not so fun. Now, I don't know that because I'm not one. I'm just telling you what I see.
People thought it was a cult. It was so bad.
So you just kept this to yourself?
Yes.
How long did it go on?
I'm not sure. I blocked a lot of it out. I would have to actually clear the bathroom before I would go to the bathroom. Because I found him in the shower, in the tub, hiding behind the curtain, trying to see me pee. And whenever I would be done with a shower, I'd have to clear my room, making sure he wasn't in there. And, because the couple times I did, he'd be hiding under the bed. As soon as I'm done with the shower, all of a sudden I find him under the bed. And that went on maybe 3-4 more times. I really don't know.
Okay.
I had to lie to myself. And I started researching how to kill myself. Went to a library and was, instead of reading what I was supposed to be, I was looking how many pills to take and how it was the least painful way to go. And, didn't tell anybody. I didn't think anyone believed me. But not only that, I think the hardest part was just being able to mentally accept it at that age with no support. I had no support. So I think if I did, I think if I had supportive parents or, you know, a supportive community, I would have been able to. But at that time, it was survival mode. I couldn't.
How do you cope with it in terms of your daily life? Do you just wall it off? That's significant trauma for a young person to then go about acting normal with. How did you do that?
It took me, it's a lot of acting. It's a lot of taking what you feel inside and turning it completely opposite, and that's what you show. So this whole myth behind, oh, you could read the signs of suicide, bullshit. Well, how many people are shocked when Robin Williams killed himself? People don't understand this. A lot of times what you see on the outside is the opposite of what that person is going through, and that's kind of what I did. I laughed. I didn't turn to negative coping methods, like, you know, going after others and hurting others. Like, a lot of people take that hurt and anger that they feel inside and they turn it on others so they can get it out of them. They can't deal with it, so they have to do what, you know, the horrible things that they went through. They have to push on others because they can't deal with it themselves. And that's not how I dealt with it. I didn't see the point in self-destructing when I had already gone through so much. I was like, why would I want to put myself through anymore? Why would I want to make my life more difficult by bad grades and skipping class and drinking alcohol and going to parties and sneaking out of the house? I didn't understand that. Because that's what my brothers were doing. My brothers, when they got older, they became alcoholics, drug dealers, domestic violence, all that kind of stuff, like failed out of school. And I didn't see the point to that. So I did the opposite, and I used that pain and that anger to motivate me to become the best person I could possibly become, because all I wanted to do was escape that environment and be happy.
My guest is Marine veteran Athena Ives. And she's written a book called Thank You for Raping Me. We're meeting her and talking about her career, and we'll talk about what inspired her to write her book. All right, so what haven't I asked about you about that incident that's important for people to know as we continue to talk about your life?
I think the most important part about that is I have had an abundance of people that I have talked to both before the book was published and after, because I shared a lot of my stories with people before the book was published, which is why I published it, because I knew there was such a need for it. And I've had so many of them reach out and tell me that they did report it to their family, and their family didn't believe them. The mom said, oh, well, I thought you enjoyed it. I thought that's what you wanted. And it's heartbreaking to hear that, but in my head, at that age, that's what I believe too, is that my parents wouldn't believe me. And a lot of times, especially, you know, with the whole Catholic Church thing, to point a finger at, you know, this man of God, how many people are going to believe you? How many people are going to believe me that my own brother, who was a master of manipulation, he was so charming and smooth. Everybody loved him. Nobody knew the truth about who he was. And that's a huge reason why I didn't, you know, come forward and tell people, because I didn't think people would believe me. And that's a huge issue with reporting. And not only are you dealing with having to report against somebody you know, I believe it's, let me see this, 93% of the perpetrators are people somebody you know. So only 7% of sexual assaults happen with someone you don't know. So 93%, and these are facts from the DOJ. It's not just Facebook posts or something like that. These are statistics. And 59% were acquaintances, and 34% were family members. So at that early age, you have to comprehend telling people that might not believe you, and then mentally dealing with it and preparing to prove that you weren't lying. And at that age, it's you aren't cognitively capable of making rational decisions. So that's why a lot of people don't report it for years. And thankfully, due to all of the different people coming forward and reporting, you know, especially with the Catholic Church, all that, it showed experts that there's a major reason why people don't report it, especially as children. And that's why they changed the statute of limitation laws in a lot of states, because they were seeing this massive, you know, amount of people coming forward that had never before. And, you know, people can say, oh, that's not true, and they're lying, they're making it up, they just want retribution or revenge or whatever. But I don't believe that, because I've had numerous people reach out and tell me, they're like, I've never told anyone. I was raped by my uncle at 7. I was raped by my cousin when I was 12. I was forced to have sex on a video camera when I was 9. They didn't report it. So why are they telling me this? What are they getting out of it? Sympathy? I don't know of very many men, or you know, like, oh, are they trying, especially if it was a man, are they trying to hook up with me, or, you know, get on my good side? Well, I don't know of very many men that would use I was raped to get in the girl's pants. Like, that doesn't work, especially with men. They don't talk about it. They don't want to ever admit it. And to live with that secret, it's like it suffocates you. And I don't know, and I know how amazing it feels to finally admit what happened. And it's described to me in the same way as I felt. And I've had people say, I finally could breathe. I could finally breathe after I told somebody. And it's this huge release of guilt and embarrassment, and especially if it's somebody that won't judge you and that has been through it as well, you feel so much better after it's done. And just to give people that opportunity to share their story with me, it's a massive burden. Like, not only do I have to deal with mine, but now I have to, you know, mentally deal with all these people reaching out to me. I just have, you know, I had 2 this morning that reached out to me and shared their stories with me. And I'm, you know, and it's just, it's supporting all the facts that are already out there, how prevalent it is, and especially in the military. Because it's not that it happens more in the military. It's just that I'm part of the military.
Right.
And a lot of the military has that mentality of saving face, and, you know, especially that masculine nature of not wanting to be vulnerable. So there's a big need for people to feel secure and that they won't be judged. And that's, I think that's what I've given a lot of people, and they've opened up, and it's just been, it's been a flood of emotions lately.
You know, the since you published your book, Thank You for Raping Me, on November 18th?
Yeah, it was around that time.
All right. Mm-hmm. The initial response still comes in. It's interesting. I had a domestic violence incident, and so, you know, I'm a Irish Catholic upper middle class kid, right? Mm-hmm. That's not supposed to affect me. At least that's what I thought. The truth is that it does. It affects everybody. It cuts through every segment of society, no matter how you slice it and dice it.
Mm-hmm.
What I found was things that surprised me. You'll hear routinely people say, if he laid a hand on me, I'd be out of here so fast, blah, 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 blah. Right? When you hear that, what do you say? You just laugh, right?
Unless they have been in that situation, they have absolutely no idea how they will react.
Right. The line that comes into my head is, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Because, it, again, I understand what they're saying, but, you know, first of all, you're doing it for the first time. It's not like, you know, you have that many people that go through this and have experience doing it. So, you know, you don't know what you're doing. You're down, you go down this road and you're embarrassed. You don't want to reach out to people to tell them what's going on. And so you do it alone. Two, and so when you hear people say stuff like that, I just cringe now. And you want to say, okay, then why do over 90% of women stay? And they look at you, well, I don't know, but I wouldn't. And you're like, you know what? The truth is you probably would. Because he's the guy in the homecoming photo. He's the guy in the photo with the baby. He's the guy in the family photo, mm-hmm. right? And there's all kinds of reasons for you to forgive what he did. It's hard shit.
Yeah.
It is hard shit. And that's why we have to get good with, you know, with reaching out to other people that have been traumatized and being accepting and supportive of that and having people know that, hey, you can come to us. We're all dealing with it. We're all dealing with it. So let's talk about, that starts when you're 13 and mm-hmm. and lasts for months, years?
Months probably.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
My sister was born shortly after, and that she saved my life. I instead of killing myself, I became her mom. I raised her.
That's awesome.
And yeah, she was
as big sisters do. And all right, so what? That's interesting. That's interesting because one of the things that you know that we all find in this whole thing called post-traumatic winning that we talk about is. Nobody can lessen your burden, the burden that you carry in your rucksack. But for whatever reason, helping others, loving others, mentoring others makes your shoulders stronger and your burden feels lighter.
I think with that, it's you, yes, like you said.
It sounds like your sister did that for you.
Yeah. You'll always have that pack.
Right.
But at least with that, she was almost like my compass.
Right.
And before that, I didn't have one, and I was just wandering around completely lost, and, you know, there was no direction. And with that, you know, you have all this weight on your shoulders, and you're wandering around, and like, what the hell am I going to do? I don't want to be here anymore. There's no hope in sight. There's no oasis in the distance. There's no water. There's nothing. It's just this vast desert you're wandering around in. But now that I know how far it's going to be or if there's a compass to guide me, it's much easier.
And she needs me.
Mm-hmm.
The So now we're going to unpause. So you're in so that's what you're doing every day, and I would imagine it's a 7 month deployment. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Give me other significant events that happened in that deployment.
May 3rd, 2008. Actually, it was May 1st, 2008. My sister's birthday is May 2nd. And I always, no matter what, I always call home. I always, you know, send her a present. I always was there, you know, to say, talk to her on her birthday. I had a convoy that next day, so I wasn't going to be able to. So I was in the phone booth or in the little phone center.
Right.
On May 1st, it was the evening. It was after work. It was probably around 9 o'clock or so. And I put my name on the waiting list. As soon as you get there, and then you, as soon as your name comes up, then you go in the booth, and then you get an hour, or I can't remember how long it is, but you get a certain amount of time. And I was in there, and I called home to say happy birthday. My mom answered, and she's like, oh, she's not here. And then I'll never forget it. She told me worst news I've ever heard in my entire life was that my sister told my mom that she had been molested. She called it, but you know, it's back then that's what people called it, but now it's actually called rape. And I flipped out. You know, I just was just like, well, what are you doing about it? Are you like? Are you going to take her to get seen? Like, what happened? Oh, no, it's just all in her head. And I had come out and confronted my family before I deployed, and they didn't believe me.
About what had happened to you previously?
Yes.
Okay.
And my brother was living there at the time, because he had just gotten divorced with his wife. He had domestic violence. He had punched her and knocked her out when she was pregnant and was in jail.
This is the same brother that raped you?
Yes.
Okay.
So he was living with my parents at the time with his daughter. They had a daughter out of the marriage, and I just knew it, especially with my mom had told me that my sister, all the traits of sexual abuse she had, and she had just been this angelic little, like, could never hurt anybody, and yet she was saying all this horrible stuff, like she wanted to kill Jewish babies with Hitler, and she wanted to hurt my brother's daughter, and that's just, you don't want to hurt somebody's daughter unless, like, it's a sign of they hurt you, and you hate them.
How old is your younger sister at the time?
She was 11.
Okay.
And I'm hearing all this stuff on the phone, and I didn't know how to deal with it, and I hear this, one of my friends is knocking on the door, telling me my time was up, because how she was reading it was when I had gotten there. Like, so I put the time on it, you know, when I had arrived, not when I actually started talking. So she's on there knocking, and, like, trying to get me out of the phone booth, and I wouldn't stop. And she was a Lance Corporal, and I was a corporal at the time. So I just opened that door, and I unleashed all hell on her. I've never said words like that in my life. I hadn't really, it was brutal, and I made her cry, and she just wanted to call home to talk to her parents for her convoy. So I didn't care. I just, you know, pretty much screamed in her face, slammed the door, and went back to talking. And my sister wasn't available at the time, so I couldn't talk to her. So I just went back to my room and just cried myself to sleep. Like, 4 o'clock in the morning, I wake up and hear just people running around and people, you know, yelling and talking really loudly, and found out that that girl that I had cussed out was blown up that night and died with 4 of my other friends. And it hit me so hard. Not only did I feel all that responsibility of, I felt like I had left my sister to him. I knew what he was capable of doing, and I left anyways. And just that guilt and that just it's worse than death. Like I can't even tell you how much more I would have rather died than to be raped. Like, it just takes so much from you, especially at that age, because it really impacts the rest of your life, and it's extremely hard to be able to deal with it and recover from that when it happens so early. And I just felt responsible, and so, it's like it was my fault.
So okay, so you, not only the feelings of your own rape, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that you didn't do anything about it. Now your younger sister, who you raise, goes through the same experience, and you're responsible for it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I felt.
All right. So now you're living with that shit with your younger sister, and then this incident dies when these Marines are killed. What happens next?
It was just a shit show. All these other problems just kept coming up, and I told my roommate, and then I went and reported it to a child psychologist, and she had to make the CPS report. My family, obviously, they found out when they came and took my sister. They just sent me a lot of hateful emails. My brothers did. Everyone did. And I had nobody. And it was, you know, I was just living with this gigantic secret. And I didn't want to come back. I didn't want to come home. I was like, I'm just causing everyone so much pain, I just might as well die out here. And just started doing some stupid stuff, you know, not being as cautious as I should have, volunteering for every type of dangerous mission. I, you know, was like, oh, can I go search the vehicles? Like, I was just begging. to be blown up or to be able to die for my country. That's all I wanted. I wasn't going to, you know, I was thinking about killing myself, but I was hoping that I didn't have to choose, that it would just, that I would be able to die for, to save people. And it just, it kind of numbed me for what, you know, what I just said about the opening up that baby. It numbed me, and it kind of helped me get through all that. Like, that didn't, that was hard, yeah, but it wasn't as hard as what I had just been through.
My guest is former Marine, Athena Ives. She's written a book called Thank You for Raping Me. The Athena, I want to take a quick break, right?
Okay.
And we'll take about a 4-minute break, and then after this, we'll continue with the story of your deployment, and then we'll come back, and you know, I know everybody wants to know, like, when does this start getting better? And I let me just tell you this: the heaviest burden that anybody bears in combat is when your negligence, right? What you're responsible for gets somebody else killed or terribly injured. That is the heaviest burden. And nobody can lift from you what you feel, mm-hmm. what you know to be true. And you are walking around with that, right, as a corporal, and it has nothing to do with your military stuff. It has everything to do with your personal life. If you don't get in touch with the right people, those can be absolutely crushing, crushing burdens. Mm-hmm. And so we need to talk about how this continues and then how you get inspired to write and which gets you where you are today. So ultimately the story, for everybody out there, the story gets better, okay? No, but it is. It's rough.
Yeah.
You know, I tell my kids, life's not for pussies, man.
No,
and when you raise your kids, if you don't raise your kids to be tough, and I don't mean just physically tough, I mean mentally tough, that they can come back from adversity, it is just as wrong as if you don't teach them how to swim.
Yeah.
It is, in my opinion, just as parentally criminal as if you don't teach your kid how to swim and he drowns or she drowns in 5 feet of water. And
yeah.
So teaching toughness is, I think, a big part of parenting, and we're going to talk about that. Don't touch that dial. More of Athena Ives. Her book, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Google. All you got to do is search the title. You can find it. It's called Thank You for Raping Me. Athena Ives, relatively unique name. So don't touch that dial. We'll continue with her next here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute, heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Yeah. Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.